and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, an associate clinical professor at Loyola Law School, and I'll be filling in for Ian Masters today. Today we're covering topics related to politics and political reform in California from three different perspectives. First, we'll hear from Anne Ravel, chairwoman of the Fair Political Practices Commission. Chair Ravel will give us the perspective on political reform from the head of a government watchdog agency that's charged with creating and enforcing regulations of elections and political activities in California. Second, we'll hear from Kathy Fung, the executive director of California Common Cause. Ms. Fung will give us the perspective of someone working for reform from outside of the government by leading a nonprofit good government group. Third, we'll hear from Tori Van Oot, who covers politics for the Sacramento Bee. Ms. Van Oot closely covered local, state, and federal campaigns this election cycle. She'll give us the perspective of a news reporter who lives and works in the state's capital. So our first guest is Chair of the Fair Political Practices Commission, Anne Ravel. She was appointed by Governor Brown in March of 2011. Most of her career was as an attorney in the Santa Clara County Council's office. Ultimately, she served as the appointed county council from 1998 until 2009. Chair Ravel, welcome. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So you've been leading the state's watchdog agency for more than a year now, and I want to talk about your experience, but I want to start off with talking about the reason you just made news, which is just days before the election, you found yourself arguing in front of the California Supreme Court. Could you explain how you got there and what that case was about?
Yes, I have to say this was quite possibly the most dramatic event of my entire legal career. The FPPC received a complaint a few weeks before the election about an $11 million contribution that was given to a PAC in California, which was funding advertisements relating to Prop 30 and 32 on the November ballot. The contribution was from an Arizona group called Americans for Responsible Leadership. They had never contributed a cent in California before, and the previous contributions that they had made in Arizona were a few and relatively small compared to the $11 million. This was the largest anonymous in the sense of we didn't know who the actual donors were, the actual people, contribution that had ever occurred in California history, but through an independent expenditure. So we contacted the attorney who was listed for the group to ask for documents concerning the contribution and who the donors were. After many days of stalling, we decided to file suit for injunctive relief, requiring them to submit to an audit by the FPPC and turn over documents that related to the contributions. The Superior Court in Sacramento granted our injunction, saying that not having them submit to the audit would be a great harm to the public in not learning the information about who the donors are before the election. So the Arizona group then appealed to the state appellate court in Sacramento asking for a stay, which was granted on the Friday before the election. We knew that a stay would eliminate our possibility of ever getting the information about the true donors prior to the election, which was crucial because getting this kind of information after an election has so much less value to the public. So we filed a petition with the California Supreme Court asking to overturn the stay and to permit the FPPC to conduct the audit. The court gave us, and we filed right away on Friday, the court gave us a briefing schedule that required the Arizona group to file opposition to our request by 5 o'clock on Saturday, and our reply would be due at noon on Sunday prior to the election. I knew that as the Arizona people were delaying everything as much as possible, they would file at 5, which they did at exactly 5. But we stayed up throughout the night, filed our reply with the California Supreme Court at about 2:15 a.m., and in a very unusual 7-0 decision on Sunday at about 2 o'clock, the court ordered that the Arizona group had to turn over their documents to the FPPC at 4. A little after 4, the Arizona group filed a request with the United States Supreme Court saying that they wanted a stay of the California Supreme Court decision, and they sent a letter to the California Supreme Court asking also for a stay in order to appeal to the United States Supreme Court. The California Supreme Court at around 5 said, no, there is no stay, and turn over the documents pretty much, although it was after the 4 o'clock time period.
So what were in those documents that were ultimately disclosed?
Well, that was very interesting because after they determined that the United States Supreme Court was probably not going to act in time, and they were already in contempt of the California Supreme Court's order, they called us and asked if it, and began in negotiations, essentially. They indicated that they were unable to provide all the documents, and what they would agree to do rather than submit to an audit. And by the way, our staff was standing by Sunday night ready to start auditing their documents. But they agreed instead that by 8 a.m. the next morning, Monday morning, they would disclose the names of the donors.
So and what did the public ultimately get as a result of that disclosure?
What the public ultimately got, unfortunately, was two other nonprofit corporations that had given the money, and in fact had given the money in kind of a seriatim way, one to the other, and then ultimately to ARL, the Arizona group.
So it sounds.
But the important thing that they learned and that we learned was that ARL admitted to having been just a shell, that they were not the actual donor. They were essentially laundering the money on behalf of other organizations.
So it sounds like, as you said, that what the ARL situation showed us is that there are a lot of problems with our current disclosure system, and ARL, if it exposed anything, exposed this shell game of individuals giving to corporations and then corporations giving to other corporations. And then what the public ultimately sees is not an individual behind the spending, but a nonprofit group. So what are the greatest problems facing our disclosure system now, and what can we do? As you said, this is important information for the public to receive before an election so that we have information about who's supporting our ballot measures and candidates.
Well, you've said it quite correctly. I mean, the greatest problem today involves these so-called social welfare groups that are tax-exempt, but they can spend money without being subject to disclosure rules, at least not on the federal level. They can't. They're supposed to be dedicated to advancing broad community interests and are technically not political organizations, but they are not really being checked by the IRS because they can spend money and begin fundraising even before the IRS recognizes them as whether as a 501c4. So they basically just send money from one group to another group and then to another group, and then they go out of existence. And it's very difficult to track who's actually the human donor at the beginning of the chain and where the money has gone.
So you're the head of California's watchdog agency. What can we do about this? How can we ensure that we do get this information to the voters before the elections and that the information they receive isn't just a series of corporate donors and spenders?
Well, California does have some requirements for disclosure of donors, which was what we were basing our allegations against ARL on. But they're definitely not stringent enough. We believe, and we're going to be seeking legislation, that it's necessary to require such groups to disclose their real donors. And one way to do that would be to look at certain factors, including if a contribution is over a certain threshold amount, and to make sure that organizations that exist in other states are bound by California law. But also, we clearly need to have greater ability to enforce our rules because, and in particular, prior to an election, we have to make sure that organizations such as these, who are extremely well-funded, our ARL group had lawyers in Washington, D.C. who were representing them. We need to make sure that we can stop them from delaying compliance with California law.
So I want to stay on this theme of disclosure for a second because I think it's such an important one. And as you said, we need to do something to pierce the corporate veil and give the public information about who's supporting what and who they're voting on. One of your previous proposals dealt with asking bloggers who are paid by campaigns to disclose that fact. And I wanted to talk about why the public has a right to know this information. I mean, if the information is out there, isn't it for the public to evaluate the veracity of the blogger's claims and really to see for themselves whether or not they support those claims?
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, to kind of set the stage about bloggers, I've seen numerous studies, primarily by the Pew Center for the Press, that indicate that most people now get political information on the internet. They're getting information in tweets, but primarily in blogs. And so the way that people are formulating their political opinions is coming from bloggers. And this is probably kind of a silly way of saying it, but it occurred to me when I was looking for a face cream to make me look younger and more beautiful, and I looked online and saw a number of people who were touting a variety of different products, and it appeared to be a blog. It absolutely did. It just seemed like your regular person who's just blogging. But then I read, and I've found out since by looking at the Federal Trade Commission's advisories, that a lot of these people are actually paid for espousing these great opinions about these skin creams that are going to make me look 30 years younger.
So this is the advertisement that's supposed to look like a news story, and it's
right.
Actually not.
Exactly. And it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's essential to democracy for people to know if someone is being paid by a campaign to promulgate an endorsement or a view. So people can factor that information in to any assessment that they make of the value to them of the information or the view. People uniformly say that those kinds of pieces of information about how seriously they could take a view is very significant to them.
Well, it seems to me that's why we have television commercials that say the spokesperson is paid for, because we need to know it's not a doctor, it's an actor who put on a doctor's coat, and we'll evaluate that message differently.
Precisely.
And you mentioned something that I think is so important, which is that the public has a right to know this information, and it brings us to something else I wanted to talk about, which is civic engagement. And I know that this is one of the areas that you've focused a lot of time on recently. And I know that you see your role as chairperson of the Fair Political Practices Commission as increasing civic engagement and public confidence. One of your original proposals was to allow people to donate via text message. Could you walk us through how that would increase civic engagement and whether that happened and worked in the most recent elections?
Mm-hmm. Many people feel that one of the problems in elections is that there is an enormous amount of money that is being spent in the campaigns, and that it is primarily funded by wealthy people. And there seems to be an increased view or assumption that large donors have all the access, and that a person who is just a grassroots kind of donor doesn't have any impact, and therefore a number of people believe that if only the wealthy have access, it kind of jeopardizes their willingness to take part in democratic governance. And that, I think, is really a problem when people feel disaffected from the political system. When you look at what happened when people contributed to the earthquake in Haiti and some of the other major relief efforts, it was found that people became very personally involved in those problems, those situations in countries far away, Japan and Haiti and other places also. And they followed it. They tended to be more concerned about it and more interested in it. And so my view was that while the amount of money that might be spent in text messaging might not be as great as what could be spent by wealthy donors, what it will do is engage people and get them more interested in the political issues. They'll get their relatives, their friends interested as well, and they'll follow things and perhaps become more involved.
So what I hear you saying is that even these small donations will essentially allow people to, quote unquote, buy into the electoral process and feel that some sort of investment in their elections and who they ultimately send to their city hall, state capital, or Washington, D.C. I think it's a great idea. I think it's certainly going to be implemented. This actually wraps up our time, so I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences as chair of the Fair Political Practices Commission with us.
Great. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
So we're going to take a brief station break, and after the break, we're going to hear from Kathy Fung. She's the executive director of Common Cause.
It's the money.